In the corner of my apartment, my two-room city apartment, there sits this rectangular cart. It's a few feet high on caster wheels. It wouldn't look out of place in a coal mine. But instead, this one is filled with yarn. All the yarn my wife has accumulated over the years. Balls of yarn, skeins of yarn, different materials, different weights, colors. The cart is an eyesore. I hate this cart. I hate that we've moved with it several times, that it takes up so much space. She knows I hate this cart. But the winter before last, unprompted, my wife digs into it. And she grabs up all the dark blue. And she sits down next to me on the couch, and she starts to knit a sweater. And this wound up taking months. She'd stitch during car trips and during Sunday night football. And slowly, this garment began to take shape. A warm, well-made, custom-fit sweater. A sweater that I now love to wear. I still hate that yarn cart, but it was a good reminder of what our clothing actually is. How much design, labor, and attention goes into each article. And that little life lesson brings us to this.
And now, here is this week's story of DuPont Chemistry.
For thousands of years, we humans only wore natural fibers. Cotton, silk, leather, wool, linen. But a century ago, scientists at DuPont began to look into durable, low-cost, synthetic materials to make our clothes with.
Well, starting in the 1920s, they decided to invest quite a bit in basic research to try and come up with these synthetic fibers from scratch.
This is Dr. Audra Wolf, a Philadelphia-based historian of science.
And so by the mid-1930s, they had some good possibilities, and they settled on one that seemed to withstand heat pretty well and that wouldn't dissolve in water. This is a huge problem if you're going to launder clothes.
DuPont's invention was nylon, the world's first commercially successful synthetic fiber, a polymer made in the lab that would soon find its way into everyone's closets. The breakthrough came at the perfect time for the company because in the 1930s, women's hemlines were starting to rise and more women were entering the workforce. The hosiery market was booming. And DuPont went all in.
So nylon is a really great fabric to make hosiery with because it's relatively resilient. You can wash it. It's relatively resistant to run. I mean, any woman who's owned a pair of pantyhose knows that they do run eventually. And if you snag them, they run. But they're more resilient than some of the other options. And they were affordable. Silk hosiery was not inexpensive. More importantly, as the world situation was changing, it was becoming more and more difficult to get silk from Japan. So all of these things kind of came together when nylon was released in the late 1930s.
So was it an immediate hit?
It was an immediate hit. Nylon went on the national market in May 1940, and they were sold out by noon.
But the working women of America didn't have nylon for long. When World War II broke out, Uncle Sam sucked up all the nylon DuPont could crank out. The fiber found its way into parachutes and flak jackets and shoelaces. So when the war ended, pent-up demand exploded in a way that's sort of hard to imagine today.
Well, people were so excited when it came back on the market. It came back on the market in 1945 in the consumer market. But by 1946, there were rumors and in some cases actual nylon riots. There's an amazing story from Pittsburgh in 1946 where 40,000 people lined up to get 13,000 pairs of pantyhose.
It can happen here, and here's the proof. On the run come the ladies to check a rumor that proves true. Free nylons just for the scramble. Yep, 600...
Today, nylon is still big business, but we're going to jump ahead about 25 years from those nylon riots to when another synthetic material arrived. And if you've ever gone hiking, you've worn it.
Well, my name is Bob Gore, and I've been working at this textile stuff for a long, long time.
Bob Gore is Gore-Tex. Though he had an assist from his dad, Bill, who coincidentally, or maybe not, was also a DuPont researcher.
And there was a particular material that he thought DuPont was not paying enough attention to. And so that was what is known as Teflon now, but is scientifically called polytetrafluoroethylene.
When the elder Gore left DuPont and launched his own company, his focus was this material, abbreviated as PTFE. His first thought was a coating to apply to the bottom of skis, since Teflon is so non-stick. But that didn't work out. So instead, W.L. Gore and Associates began using the material in electrical wiring equipment, which it successfully marketed to IBM. A few years later, 1969, the younger Gore was tinkering with a rod made out of heated PTFE to see if he could make something else.
The vision was a very lowly vision. It was to make cheaper plumber's tape. So I always put that in when we think that visions have to be lofty. They sometimes are pretty mundane.
By rapidly stretching the PTFE at high temperatures, basically jerking it, Gore figured out a way to introduce air into the material. The result was this thin, membrane-like substance that, under a microscope, looks like a spider web. The holes are small enough that they resist droplets of water, but the holes are big enough that water vapor, such as the sweat coming off your body, can pass through it. It was the first waterproof, breathable material.
The Gore-Tex, as most people know it in garments, is a membrane that is adhered to a textile fabric.
Gore-Tex revolutionized hiking, camping, running shoes, boots, and it also found its way into medical devices, astronaut suits, even dental floss. The company is still rolling out new uses for it.
Where there's human ingenuity, there's going to be progress.
Along with ingenuity, a little bit of money helps too. To kickstart the creation of next-generation fibers, things that can follow in nylon and Gore-Tex's footprint, the Obama administration announced a $320 million initiative earlier this year. It brings together some of the country's best schools, including MIT, plus big companies and the Department of Defense. Here's Secretary of Defense Ash Carter announcing the project.
This is a pioneering field, combining fibers and yarns with things like flexible integrated circuits, LEDs, solar cells, electronic sensors, and other capabilities to create fabrics and cloths that can see, hear, sense, communicate, store energy, regulate temperature, monitor health, change color, much more.
As Carter sees it, these functional fabrics could someday let a soldier know when he's at risk from chemical weapons, or allow a Navy SEAL to carry more battery power for his GPS unit without carrying extra weight. And the idea is these innovations will eventually trickle down into a range of consumer goods. Genevieve Dion is spearheading a team at Drexel University involved in this far-reaching project.
Functional fabric is one of the most transdisciplinary fields of our time, right? So you need material scientists, you need modelers, you need mechanical engineers, you need designers, you need system integration, you need electrical engineering, you need all the fields.
These are early days in the pursuit of next-generation materials. There are still lots of technical challenges to work out, and, you know, nobody's going to want to look like they're wearing a circuit board.
I think the day that we will be really, really successful with functional fabric is when you do not know they're there. So our goal is to be invisible in a way.
Invisible in the same way that nylon hosiery just looks like hosiery, and a Gore-Tex jacket doesn't look all that futuristic. My dark blue sweater, handmade with wool yarn, isn't smart, it isn't synthetic, and it isn't good in the rain. But it is a piece of clothing, an arrangement of fibers carefully assembled, that means a great deal to me. It's perhaps the only thing that, when I wear it, I know exactly all that went into it.